Welcome once again to the psychedelicparenting.org podcast. I am your host, Jonathan. Before we begin today, we would like to remind everyone that tickets are still available for the upcoming Women's Visionary Congress First Annual New York Salon, which will be held Saturday, March 12th from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Alchemist's Kitchen, 21 East 1st Street, New York City. There will also be a free gathering on Friday the 11th at the Rubin Museum and an outdoor exhibit in Central Park on Sunday the 13th. Symposia will also be hosting a psychedelic stories event entitled Visionary Women on Saturday night. The salon will feature talks by Catherine McLean, Julie Holland, and Allison Gray. If you're on the other coast, there will be a fundraiser for the upcoming Exploring Psychedelics conference at Oberon's Tavern in Ashland, Oregon on Saturday, March 12th, beginning at 8 p.m. If you're in Southern Oregon, come out and listen to Fractal Love Jam and help keep Exploring Psychedelics free to all who attend. Finally, I announced last week that I would be appearing at WKAR Radio's Pop-Up Stories event in Old Town, Lansing, Michigan. Due to the huge snowstorm we experienced in mid-Michigan last week, that event was rescheduled to tomorrow, Thursday, March 3rd, starting at 6 p.m. I will be sharing a 5-minute story about my healing from alcoholism through the intervention of ayahuasca. Also, if you like what you hear and would like to support our work, please consider a tax-deductible gift through our fiscal sponsor, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. A link can be found in the program notes to this podcast. Today's guest on the Psychedelic Parenting Podcast is Abdul Dooley Wilkins, a.k.a. the Beantown Ghetto Shaman. Dooley is a husband and a father to a 1-year-old daughter. He is also a visual artist, certified massage therapist, Reiki master, yoga teacher, and intuitive healer from Boston. He grew up in the inner city of Roxbury and was influenced by his father and mother from a very young age in regards to metaphysics, mysticism, occult information, and spirituality. In college at Northeastern University, Dooley was introduced to psilocybin mushrooms, which opened him up more deeply to the spiritual world. Dooley has since been exploring the benefits of teacher plants and fungus. He advocates the use of entheogens in a sacred manner and teaches people in Boston about the distinctions between the scourges of drugs and the healing powers of teacher plants. Dooley strongly believes that urban shamanism can heal trauma-based issues, bring people together from various backgrounds and races, and bring a new, found awareness of self and connection to the earth and the Great Spirit. This belief is lived out through his commitment with his wife Yolanda to leading nature walks in the city and teaching community elders about the healing benefits of mushrooms and other plants. They are also organizing an urban shamanism conference, which Dooley will discuss today. I met Dooley about 1 year ago this time at Symposia 2015, where he and I were both speakers. At the time, I was intrigued by his dynamic persona and unique presentation, and I'm very excited to finally have him on today. So without further ado, I'd like to say welcome, Dooley, to Psychedelic Parenting. Thanks for being on the show.
Hey, welcome. Peace. How you doing, Jonathan?
I'm doing great, sir. And how are you?
Oh, doing wonderful. I can't complain. Just came from work and just sat down and did some meditation and some Reiki, just preparing myself to spend some time talking with you.
Awesome. So getting started, why don't you tell us a little bit, since this is psychedelic parenting, just tell us a little bit about your family.
Well, I have a 1-year-old daughter, beautiful daughter. Her name is Dendara, which is actually an Egyptian temple, actually dedicated to the zodiac sign. So, So I'm really into Egyptian mythology and mythology in general. Mm-hmm. So I came up with the name, and my wife's name is Yolanda, and it's funny that me and Yolanda grew up with each other on the same street as children, and we didn't see each other till probably 20 some years later, because my wife's a dancer, and she dances all kind of different styles, and I seen her at this fashion show, and that's how we reunited, and it's been beautiful ever since, you know. And
So how long have you guys been married?
We've been together about almost 3 years now.
How old is your daughter?
She's one. Just turned one last month.
She was really small when you guys were at Amherst last year. I remember she's tiny.
Yeah. She was taking it all. all the speakers in too. It was really funny. She was like, really like sitting there, like she was listening to the whole lectures and everything. So yeah, it was really, that was an awesome experience being down there, you know, a lot of great people I met that day. You know?
Right on. So why don't you tell us, a little bit about your background and the work that you do, and how your psychedelic experiences tune into that.
Okay, well, I'm from the Boston area. You know, I grew up in Roxbury, which is a inner city in Boston, and my father and my mother, I have to give credit to them, even being kind of into a lot of things that I'm into. So my father, you know, he went to Woodstock in his early years, and was, you know, very familiar with the hippie scene of the 60s, seeing Jimi Hendrix play live and all that. And my father also was, used to play jazz music. So he got a chance to meet a couple of famous jazz musicians and even got a chance to play with the famous jazz musician, Pharoah Saunders. Met Miles Davis, Dizzy Gillespie and stuff. And also my mom, real great artist. She was graduated from Mass College of Art, abstract artist. And they both, you know, I had a very interesting upbringing because my father taught me a lot about meditation, yoga, Tai Chi, a lot of different Eastern philosophy and stuff. As a youngster, you know, and it was interesting because we was like more of the black sheep of the neighborhood because, you know, I grew up vegetarian and drinking herbal teas and stuff. But, you know, I would walk out of, you know, down the street from my neighborhood and it was a lot of gangs and a lot of that type, a lot of violence and a lot of different type of activity like that happening in my neighborhood. So it was a very interesting way how I grew up because even though I was very inspired by both my mother and father, I kind of had, you know, to find my own way and for my own survival, actually, you know. And, you know, I think it was age 11, I got jumped by these older guys and, you know, I didn't know anything about gangs. My grandmother just put a winter hat on me. And I didn't know I was going to after school program and it was the wrong street, I guess, that, you know, had the wrong color or whatever. And, they beat the crap out of me. I had to run for my life. And, you know, a lot of, you know, I've seen a lot of, traumatic things growing up. So I kind of pushed the spiritual thing, the metaphysical thing kind of aside and kind of was doing my own thing, but it was in until like my late teens, probably, about to graduate from high school that I started to get more back in tune with myself. And I got a scholarship to Northeastern University. I was studying art and theater there at the time. And it was through a good friend of mine who I really got my first taste of the psilocybin mushroom, which really changed my life in a lot of ways. And so, yeah, that was very interesting. And for work, I'm a massage therapist. Been doing that for about 7 years now, and I also do energetic healings with my clients and chakra balancing, sound therapy, different things like that.
Right on, cool. So yeah, we have that in common. I am also work in the field of holistic health. I'm a office manager for a massage clinic, so I don't have the magic hands like you do, but I make sure that the magic hands come to work on time.
Nice.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about that first psilocybin experience and how it affected you?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I've been smoking marijuana or weed since 14, you know, and you know, that's not a big thing within the black community, within the Afro-American community, particularly in the inner city. We call them smoking blunts, which we wrap our marijuana with, like tobacco leaves and stuff. So I always, from a very young age, instinctively, I saw even marijuana as a type of sacrament, a tool to be used to really go within. And maybe it's because of kind of my family background too, because I learned about the Indian sadhuds. I'm probably not saying
the
name
sadhus,
correct.
Sadhus, yeah,
the sadhuds, which were more veneration to the Shiva type of religion, but you know, and also the Rastafarians. Mm-hmm. So that whole concept of using ganja, or using herb as a tool to go within. Mm-hmm. So I had that type of awareness as a youth. And it was a little strange for me because I would be around my peers, and it seemed like they were there just to smoke this, to get, you know, get high and just, you know, get tuned out or whatever. But for me, I always instinctively knew there was something else more there for me. So that was kind of a battle for me because I always wanted to go kind of deeper with even marijuana, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but other than marijuana within the inner city, there was really no usage of psychedelic drugs or, mm-hmm. or, you know, or teaching plants or fungi or anything.
Yeah.
That's something, I guess for black people would say it was more of a white thing, you know? Mm-hmm. So it wasn't until, college that, I came across a friend, real good friend of mine. She said, I was at a party, and she said, you know, I have some mushrooms, and she said, hey, you want to try, Dooley? And I kind of tuned in with my inner self and asked myself, hey, you know, should I take this? And my inner self said, yeah, go for it, you know. So mm-hmm. I took the mushrooms, and it was a very intense, it was a very deep experience for me, because one thing that I noticed was that I was perceiving things happen before they were happening. So I would see my friend get up, walk over, talk to my other friend in my mind's eye, and then a couple of seconds later, I would actually see it play out. That was kind of trippy to me. And then, you know, I seen like something that looked like these geometric shapes that seemed like it covered everything. It looked kind of like that scene from The Matrix, when Neo became enlightened or what have you, and uh-huh. you've seen all those numbers everywhere.
Right, yeah.
That's kind of what I've seen. But it was like these geometric type shapes, and that covered everything. And it reminded me of something like, I was like looking at the fabric of reality, or a big energetic quilt of some sort, or something like that. So, and you know that, you know, and then of course, towards the end of my journey, you know, a little paranoia came in, you know, mm-hmm. I really, into UFOlogy, and, so I thought the aliens were hovering above, the party, above the building. So I got a little scared.
Well,
so,
yeah, you're in good company with that situation. 'Cause, you know, Terrence McKenna, he had lots of things to say about the UFOs. And then his book, True Hallucinations, towards the end, he has this, he's in the jungle and he walks out to the river. They're waiting for this helicopter or something to come pick them up. And he sees a UFO like hovering overhead. And so you're in good company.
Yeah, Terrence is you know, I'm familiar with some of his work. He's a really deep person. And, you know, I that first time, because of I'm seeing that a lot of these teaching plants, fungi, have a lot to do with what's going on in your subconscious mind. So my second journey, I was like, hey, you know, I want to kind of deal with a lot of that subconscious type of things that are happening with me, which was the second time was amazing, but the first time was pretty interesting, you know. Yeah. So
right on. So one of the things that's interesting, I was just listening to a short YouTube video they did today, and you were talking about a project that you're working on, which you said is called the Urban Shaman Conference. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, that's something I'm trying to put together, definitely probably towards the end of the summer. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of people on board already that want to be involved in it, Baba Kalindi, a gentleman named Brother Honk, also this very interesting elder named Baba Awolowo. So I have a couple of people on board for this, and what I was trying to bring together was basically a conference for people in the inner city, particularly people of color, to be able to have awareness about this whole movement. I think we're in a very, very interesting time because it wasn't until, like, as you know already, the 1960s with guys like Timothy Leary, Ram Dass, and such, where this big movement happened. Yet, you know, I think it's on the rise once again, because what now we have, as you know, medical establishments, you know, like John Hopkins University, different people who are actually studying a lot of these teaching plants and fungi and taking the approach that it has a lot of benefit to our health, for our mental health, everything. So I think we're at a great time, and because you know, my past experiences with different plants and fungi, I just want to offer it to my greater community and see it as a tool that can really help people. And the reason why I think, again, particularly Black folk, people of color, aren't aware of these particular teaching plants and fungi, and because when I approach, especially when I approach some of the elders within my community about this subject, it's a reaction where, oh, no, Dooley, we don't need none of that here in the community here. And it's a very common reaction. And the reason why I believe it's is because of historical of the things that happened within the Black community. I'm not sure if people are familiar, listeners, with the guy named Freeway Ricky Ross. But they made a movie about this gentleman not that long ago, which was talking about the connections between the CIA and bringing crack cocaine within the Black community. So there was, and you know, and I was a little, I was a young guy growing up in the early 80s, but I remember the drastic, you know, the effects of how that really, really tore down many Black communities. And because of that, a lot of Black people, any association with any so-called mind-altering substance, people are like, no, we don't need that. We don't need anything like that. We already know what happened with the so-called crack era and even the heroin type of situation for many Black soldiers that came back from the Vietnam War. So there's a lot of Black folks that don't even want to be open to that type of scenario. So my thing is to try to bring experts in that can really teach people that there's a difference, a big difference between what we call drugs and teaching plants, teaching fungi.
Yeah.
So that's kind of my mission, you know?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. That's really great. And, you know, I think that that Kalindi is definitely in that same camp as you. It's like, we are really making this a part of your community. And then we recently had a passing of somebody else who had was doing great work in that. And that was Kai Wingo too. And
Yes. Sister Kai. Oh my goodness. I remember we had that conversation, cause I talked to Baba Kalindi, and he told me, you know, actually I called Kai, about almost 4 weeks ago, because he was supposed to be one of the people one of the teachers that were going to be a part of this conference. And I called about 4 or 5 weeks ago, and I spoke to her daughter, and her daughter was like, oh, you know, she's in the hospital, but I think she's okay. And I'm hearing her, and I'm like, hospital? Like, what's going on with your mother? And she told me that her daughter told me that she was in a coma. So I was like, I didn't know how to react. I was like, oh my God. So I automatically called Kalindi, and Kalindi told me that he was at the hospital at the time, you know, with her, and she was in the coma. And then I just talked to you the other day, and I found out that she passed away. So which was a big blow for me. I was like, you know, I never met Kai personally. We would talk over the phone all the time about mushrooms and metaphysics and all kind of different subjects. And, you know, it was a big blow because from what I know, she was a big asset to her community. She, you know, was not only talking about psilocybin mushrooms, but medicinal mushrooms as well. She had a mushroom farm. And from what I know, she was even working with even battered women, people, women of color who went through so much different trauma, and we had a woman's circle, which I found was amazing. You know, so I just found that was great work that she was doing, and I definitely wanted her a part of this conference. But yeah, it's sad. But I talked to Kalindi today, yeah, and he told me that Kalindi's something else. He's a very interesting man. But yeah. He told me that he took 40 grams of psilocybin mushrooms, and he was able to contact Kai and in the spirit world, he said. And he said he spoke to her, and he said that she, quote-unquote, said that she's fine. And for people not to be sad, and that she's going to be helping us from the realm where she's at.
Nice.
So I found that amazing. And when Kalindi said that, I believe it was a week before he even did that to go seek her out into the spirit world, he'd seen something on X-Files where the character, what's his name, Mulder, was in this particular, it's a recent X-File episode for y'all to check out, where he, Mulder, was trying to solve this type of crime or some situation. I haven't seen the episode yet, but Kalindi was telling me about it. But this character, this particular character in that episode was in a coma, and Mulder took some psilocybin mushrooms.
Really?
To reach this person. Yeah.
This is the new X-Files series.
New X-Files. I got to check it out, man. So me and Kalindi had a good laugh on that one. I'm like, wow, people are really, even Hollywood are starting to really catch on to certain things, you know, so I found that interesting.
Yeah, that's awesome. So speaking of converting the elders, you shared with me earlier that there was a story that you wanted to tell about introducing your mother to psychedelic mushrooms.
Yeah. Well, you know, my mother is amazing. I love my mom so much. And she's one of a kind person. And I'm not saying that because she's my son. She's just wild. And she's a hippie of her own type, in her own right, you know. And my mom, unfortunately, you know, I didn't grow up with my mom. And it was because she was diagnosed with schizophrenia, you know. So, you know, the thing that's so interesting about my mom is that she can be so very in tune with just with the world and spirituality, and just the sweetest person I ever know. But then there's times where she's very unbalanced. And that's another reason why the courts had to get involved with me and my sister and, you know, and have my father get custody and stuff. But it was interesting because maybe I believe, because how I grew up and that my mother was diagnosed with schizophrenia was a motivation for me to really look in how healing, what causes people to get sick, or how can people approach this from a very holistic way. So I asked my mom, I was like, hey, Ma, you know, I've been doing some research about how psilocybin mushrooms can really help people rewire the brain. And all kinds of things. And so my mother was all game. She was all good for it. And so she took the first session, and I think I gave her 5 grams. And she had the most wonderful time. I mean, she felt blissed out. She was, you know, I played some relaxing music in the background. And she just felt very grounded and in tune with herself. So I thought it was amazing, you know. And I just feel it's another testament, you know, just to show that people, you know, can have a choice to deal with these things. You know, it's like the other day I seen something online. It was a young boy who was having seizures, and this mother got a hold of cannabis oil, and the boy was having like I don't know how many seizures per day. But he took her son took the cannabis oil, and he hasn't had, all the seizures that he was having really went down. So I'm just looking at, you know, different routes and different ways to approach healing. And again, that it was my mom as a tool for me to really get into this, to look at what healing really is about. And it just reminded me even some of my journeys as well, mm-hmm. because, again, even like what, like I was saying with even smoking herb or marijuana, I never saw this as just something for a person to trip out or get high. Mm-hmm. You know, I seen it always as an opportunity for healing. And every time I go on a journey, I really try to approach it from that level, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and because I do that, I think I get a lot of benefit from it. Case being, I had, one journey, it was not that long ago, about probably 2 months ago, actually, where, I think I took about 10 or 15 grams of psilocybin mushrooms. And, my, wife's, grandmother came to me, you know, and, it was very interesting because she was just telling me, things like, hey, you know, giving me basically advice on how to deal with my marriage a little better, you mm-hmm. know, and say, hey, don't take things so serious mm-hmm. sometimes with Yolanda and this. And again, it's just for some listeners, this might be over their head. Some people might really resonate with what I'm saying, but I think it's amazing that people can have, like Kalindi was saying, having connection with people who've passed away. Mm-hmm. And for me, that conversation with her grandmother really helped me out. Mm-hmm. And I took that advice to heart. Mm-hmm. It was another time that something similar happened, to the same effect, where, I took about 15 or 20 grams of psilocybin, and, I was laying on the couch and I went to this particular realm where, it was these two beings. One that came to me, he was a very fatherly type of being, and he was just giving me all this advice. He knew everything about me, which was amazing. And he was like, hey, you're a father now. You need to just get things done. Do it. Boom, boom, boom. And then right after he left, it was this motherly type of figure. She was, seemed like just a very loving aunt, and she she was funny as hell too. She was very sassy, and she was giving me advice too. He was like the fatherly figure was like the more stern type of, like, hey, get this done, da 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 da. And then when she came, it was like, hey, don't take things so serious. And you know, when your wife is doing this, come on, you need to chill out, Dooley. And you know, I mean, I felt like I was getting counseling from a celestial level. You know what I mean? Sure, and for me, I'm like, wow, that's deep. So I think a lot of people, there's so much benefit to this. And there's so many things that I think people are not even aware of yet that we can tap into. And, you know, like some people say, we only use 5 to 10% of our brain power. I've heard that, you know, uh-huh. and you had movies like, Lucy, you know, and even Limitless,
right,
which are two great movies in my opinion, which kind of highlighted that idea of what happens to a person when we start to tap in more, you know, and when we're able to do that, who knows what we're really capable of, you know? And in my opinion, that's, you know, that's the real, where the so-called conspiracy theorists come out of me when I think, like, you know, this is a reason why these so-called teaching plants, fungi, are illegal, because, you know, it, if people are more aware, more open, more accessible to certain things, we're not easily to be controlled, you know, by these world bankers, by all these different things, and by the one percenters, all these things. So I think that's important to look at, and that's something I used to even talk to my father about. I was like, hey, what happened to the hippie movement? What happened to all these movements? And I think from that perspective, even in the 1960s, you know, you have all of a sudden, especially white America, you know, these young men and women just wake it, like Timothy Leary says, hey, tune in, you know, tune, drop out, tune in. What, I forget his slogan, but you know, yeah, like on, basically tune in, drop out, you know? So all of a sudden you have all these young kids, you know, and my father was there to testify, hey, you know, they're putting the flowers and the guns and, you know, hey, why are we fighting anyway? You know, we're all one. What the hell is this about? You know what I mean? And, you know, and like the shamans being custodians and protectors of the earth. So, you know, you have, you know, all of a sudden these hippies saying, hey, you know, there's no need for us to be, you know, taking all these natural resources and all that. It was more awareness. Mm-hmm. So, and from my research, you know, you had, what's his name, Charles Manson, which some people said was actually a CIA agent who was an implant to really spread that fear for people to say, oh, well, these drugs or these things are dangerous, you know, yeah, this whole propaganda machine. Right. So, you know, I think that was intentional for the so-called powers that be. So I think we're back at a place where people can really approach it from a more serious place and be look at it from a more respectful, you know, from a place that's more respectable. And also, you know, I think we're at a time where, you know, we're at the information age. So we people can reach out to these authentic shamans and medicine men and medicine women who have the background traditionally of knowing how to use these things in ways that could bring so much benefit to people, you know, rather than, hey, I'm just going to trip out, you know? Right. Yeah.
So what I'm interested in hearing is when you first gave your talk at Amherst and you introduced yourself as the Beantown Ghetto Shaman, I thought one of the things that I thought about that is I'm interested in how you see shamanism expressing itself in the inner city, and how do you live that role? Because I have lots of conversations with white people about how can we be authentic? Because, you know, white people have a tendency to kind of just like pick and choose pieces of you know, black and brown culture that we like and dispose of the other parts and not really, really value it in the right way, I think. And what I've tried to do is say, well, you know, how can we have authentic medicine traditions that are ours without, you know, cribbing disrespectfully the traditions of other people? So I'm interested in hearing how you know, the concept of shamanism expresses itself in the inner city for you.
Well, the thing that's interesting about it, first of all, that's a wonderful question, by the way, and very, 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 very good. And I think the thing that's very interesting is for black people first to understand that it's a tradition of shamanism that's tied to us, to black people in general. That's the first thing, because some people, when they think of shamanism, they automatically go to Siberia, or their first thought is some shamans in the Amazon or in South America or whatever. But I have to give credit to Baba Kalindi of at least from a historical level, tying in how there was an African presence of shamanism.
Yeah, he does.
And how that tied into, for instance, the Maasai warriors, how they have the Assyrian root, and how that tied in their uses of mushrooms too within the Dogon tribe, and all these things, you know. And even Kalindi was talking about how the earliest forms of mushroom use that he believes that was down in recorded was in South Africa, in some of these deep internal caves. So I found that amazing. And when the brother said about how he even made a connection of saying Harriet Tubman was a shaman, that just blew my mind. Yeah. I was like, what the fuck? Yeah. I was like, are you serious? So to me, I was like, that's amazing, because for him to say that Harriet Tubman used mushrooms as a navigational tool to be able to better equip herself psychically, to be able to know when the slave catchers were on her heels, and things of that nature, to go through the Underground Railroad more safely. I mean, that's brilliant itself, you know. So to me, I
get to the bathroom on mushrooms, let alone get slaves out of the South.
It's deep. She was a very powerful woman, you know. The thing is that, you know, to know first for black people to understand that there's a tradition.
Yeah.
It might be a hidden tradition that they don't know of, but to first understand that that's there for them. And second of all, I believe that you have something called ancestral memory. So a lot of the type of things that I do are on the level of ancient memory. You know, I'll give you a case in point. There was one time where I was, you know, I was doing a mushroom experience in this beautiful park in Boston called the Arboretum. And it was very interesting because I seen three past lives that evening. Mm-hmm. And one of my past lives, I was an Asian man who was a healer during that lifetime as well, and was a martial artist too. And because martial arts always been a part of my life as well, and you know, since I was young. But what was so interesting that evening is that I went into this spontaneous type of martial arts style. I just got up and started doing this style that I never studied during this lifetime.
Oh, that's
and it blew my mind because I was like, where did this just come from? Mm-hmm. So again, a lot of this stuff is within our DNA. Mm-hmm. It's on the level of ancestral memory. Mm-hmm. I remember I came across an article that even talked about that with Holocaust victims. A lot of them had trauma-based memories from their ancestors. And to me, that stuff blows my mind because, a lot of stuff, good and bad, are embedded within us that on a very subconscious level that we don't even, or that we're not aware of. So you're talking about,
in the case of the Holocaust, you're talking about like the children and grandchildren of the people who
yes.
were in the
yes,
camps.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I find that amazing. I you know, horrific for them, of course, but you know, amazing on the level that we have all these experiences, even mm-hmm. from our ancestors,
yeah.
that's locked in with our DNA.
Uh-huh.
So to me, even though we might not have, for Black people, even though they might not have a written type of shamanic system or anything that's currently, I believe all that stuff is in us.
Sure.
And if a person takes the time to tap or go within, I think it can happen. It confirms to me a lot of these things are within us. And a lot of my journeys have been around my intuition, uh-huh. really putting my intuition to work and saying, hey, trusting the process. So again, for the inner city, for the Black community, like there was a gentleman at that conference as well who served, I believe he served in Iraq. And he was a military guy. I don't know if you remembered his story, but
Ryan LeCompte. Yeah. Yeah.
He's a good guy. Very good guy. But the thing about that guy, he was dealing with, like a lot of veterans, dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder,
mm-hmm.
you know, and he's saying how he couldn't sleep and all this. And he's saying how ayahuasca was a tool to help him heal himself.
Yeah.
So for me, you know, the environment that I grew up in, you know, like I was saying earlier, the gangs and different things. And a lot of this is a reflection of poverty, the crack era, even like I'm saying, ancestral memory. You have a lot of Blacks that dealt with the transatlantic trade, the slavery and all that. So there's a lot of trauma for so many people. So for Black folk, like, for instance, he dealt with war and had a level of using the plants to help him. There's a lot of wars happening here in the streets of the inner city. You have the Crips, you have the Bloods, you have the, so many different gangs out there. And some of these individuals who gave up that life and want to turn a new leaf, how can we help them? You know?
Yeah.
So and just like Kai, what she was doing, you're having a woman circle of women who were had trauma and were abused, using these tools as a way to help ex-gang members, to help ex-prostitutes, to help people who have even issues surrounding their ancestry dealing with slavery and stuff.
Uh-huh.
So I think it's so much potential that can actually happen on a level of healing. And from my experience with dealing with at least psilocybin, is every experience that I come from, even if it's intense, at the end of those journeys, I come back a better man. I Amen. Swear to God, I feel more gratitude for life, for myself. I'm accepting myself more. And I think that's a great just thing that comes along with the package.
Uh-huh.
You know, you go on these journeys and you see These that's why they're teaching plants. That's why they're teaching fungi. Right. Because they're the greatest guru you could ever have. They're there to put that mirror up to you and say, oh, well, you know, let's work on this.
Yep.
Well, you don't need this anymore.
Yeah.
That idea about your race or about you yourself, you gotta let that go.
Uh-huh.
You know, and that's where the healing comes in. You know, that's where the healing comes in. Because every journey I've come from, it's like, hey, you know, I'm accepting myself. I accept the baby fat, accept the daggone, the daggone grays that might be coming in your hair, you know, the wrinkles, whatever. It's that level of self-love. And I guarantee that's one thing that happens with these teaching plants and the teaching fungi. You know, it's that level of real healing. And it doesn't matter what race you are, what class, whatever background you come from, the medicine's there for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's there for everyone, you know?
Yeah, especially, and you know, one of the things that I've taken from listening to Kalindi is, you know, he's very much about, you know, the mushrooms they're very accessible, very easy to cultivate, and, you know, it doesn't take a lot of money, it doesn't take a lot of space, and, you know,
it's
like if you want to grow real good kind bud, it's going to take you a lot of energy and a lot of money and a lot of expertise. But, you know, to grow some mushrooms, all you need is a big plastic tub and some cow shit and it's pretty much it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I had a friend that was teaching me how to grow them, uh-huh. and they're very easy to grow.
Yeah.
And like you said, you could put them in your closet and there you go, you know? So I think it's a teaching fungi. The teaching fungi is a great tool for the inner city. It's a great tool for the working class, for your working class man, working class woman.
Yep.
It doesn't have to take a lot to get it going. You know, you can, you know, and it's a beautiful thing because you're growing it yourself. You could put your own energy into it.
Yeah.
I put crystals near mine. I had even a little bag on. I bought a figurine of this little fairy looking guy. I put him in there. You know, I put your own energy, your whole love into it, and it's a beautiful thing, you know. So I mean, that's the big thing, and I wanted to definitely come on the show because there's so many stereotypes that are associated with the psychedelics or the ethogens or the teaching plants or what have you, and especially for parents.
Mm-hmm.
Let's be for real. You know, a lot of people, when they look at this type of subject, they're saying, oh, you know, he's a stoner, she's a stoner, oh, they must be unresponsible, they can't hold a job, it must be their kids must be go starving or running crazy. And it's the total opposite.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like I said before, these things make you a better person.
Right.
So it's even teaching you how to be a better husband, better wife, how to be a better father, you know, a better mother, you know what I mean? This is, it's brilliant.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're here to bust that stereotype, to bust that bubble, so people can have a better understanding what this is about. And it's time, it's really time for this to happen, you know?
I totally agree. I totally agree, man. Yeah. So tell me how you plan to pass these values and teachings onto your daughter as she grows.
Well, you want to hear something interesting? She's a shaman already. I swear to God, man. Listen, man, you know, it blew my mind because one night I was in this particular realm and I was helping all these particular, I was in a lower realm that night. And I was helping all these beings. I was doing all these healings for these people that night.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing this for, I mean, a couple of hours.
Uh-huh.
My mother-in-law came into the spirit world as well. And I was doing some healing for her, too, when she came up. The thing is, by the time she came up, I felt like I didn't have enough energy to send her to do another healing. And do you know what happened? My daughter popped up in the spirit world and started assisting me in the healing for her grandmother. That shit blew my mind. I was like, what the hell? I was like, daughter, how you get here? You know, so, I mean, the whole laws of the spirit world and different things like that are very different than how we perceive and look at things in this physical realm,
uh-huh.
in this third dimension, on how we perceive age, intellect, and all those other things. So my daughter is very in tune and already. And like a lot of people, even in the new age community, people that deal with metaphysics, occult information, a lot of people believe a lot of these children that are coming out are coming out very advanced.
Uh-huh.
You know, some people would say the crystal children or the indigo children, what
right.
have you.
Uh-huh.
And there's a great book, actually. I think it's called The Psychic Children of China. I believe that's, I forgot the author, but
uh-huh.
it's interesting. They are highlighting all these children in China that are being born with these so-called supernatural abilities.
Uh-huh.
And it was like children who you could blindfold them and they could see, you know, with their eyes closed, and
wow.
you know, people, children who were able to walk through walls, all kinds of shit. This shit's crazy. And it's interesting because this is what this book and other people are trying to say, is that so-called junk DNA is being activated
uh-huh.
with these new generation of children.
Uh-huh.
And I totally believe that. I believe that's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to evolve. And like I said before, if people are saying that we're only using 5 to 10% of our brain power, then why not? We're supposed to, you know, the human race supposed to evolve and grow into something else, you know? So I find this a very interesting time. And my daughter is just very advanced. I mean, she's teaching me stuff.
yeah.
You know, so, but, you know, in regard to just the shaman path and things like that, I'm just going to be totally honest with her, even as she gets older, like my father did, like my mother did to her best ability,
mm-hmm.
to show me that this, you know, that you, there's more realities than just this, that, you know, we have a lot of capabilities that most people aren't aware of. And if it's a calling for you, definitely check it out. Definitely look into it, you
mm-hmm.
know, because it could be very fulfilling and satisfying, you know. So, yeah, I just try to be real open to it. I think honesty and being open is the key, because you're going to have a lot of people outside of the family household that's going to be saying other things. Oh, you know, they're dealing with psychedelics, drugs, or whatever.
Right.
So I want her to be open and from a very young age to know that I'm daddy, mommy, you know, none of us are hiding anything from you.
Yes, right.
You know, and
yes.
that this is a lifestyle that your daddy has chosen because it really helps him.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too, because when we did the interview with Brett a couple weeks ago, his stepson actually came in and talked with us, and it was really enlightening, and it reaffirmed a number of things that I've observed in other people who are raised by psychedelic parents, and
mm-hmm.
and one of those things is that those kids seem to be, at least the ones that I've talked to, seem to be like really, really well adjusted and not really interested in, like, you know, abusing drugs and that kind of stuff.
That's
just,
right.
Because the way that these substances are presented in their home. Well, I think, you know, one of the
mm-hmm.
things that Brett said, and I agree with him, is that, you know, if you're really into drugs, then your kids aren't going to rebel and do drugs because that's dad's thing. So there's that sort of protection. But also they sort of, you know, they see that they're given an honest
yeah.
education about what are the benefits of these things and what are the drawbacks, and, you know, let's make intelligent decisions about the way that we're going to, you know, alter our minds instead of just doing it to, you know, like you said, just to get high or whatever.
Yeah. I think again, we're at a place where, like, for instance, but it was one of my, journeys where, you know, I was smoking a lot of weed as a teenager. Right. And it was one of my psilocybin experiences where I even had a joint rolled ready to smoke when I was going to come down from my experience. And
uh-huh.
that night I said to myself, hey, you know, I want anything that's not serving me anymore. I just want to let go, you know? And I remember there was a lot of purging that night, and I tried to light the joint, man. It tasted disgusting to me.
Mm.
And I couldn't smoke it, and I haven't been smoking since. So a lot of these, and not to say there's anything wrong with people smoking weed and stuff, but for me, it's not the journey for me to take right now. And what's interesting is, like what I'm saying is, when a lot of these things are teaching plants, they're medicine, in a lot of ways, that ayahuasca, as you know, iboga or ibogaine, is being used throughout Europe, different places, for addiction.
Yeah. Right.
So these things are not, you know, they're not, they were meant to bring us back in order.
Yes.
You know, to, they were meant to bring us at a place of harmony and peace.
Right.
So, you know, the things that we're using or talking about are not things that people would normally get addicted to anyway.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, and furthermore, you know, the whole thing of alcoholism and people getting addicted to certain drugs is just a reflection of the society we're living in. You know, I remember I came across something about addiction, and this person I was talking about this, it's not so much the substance of what people are taking. It's a reaction to loneliness. It's a reaction to something empty inside a person. So we have to look at our society, and we have to examine it and take a real big microscope to it, and see how we can have a more authentic experience.
Mm-hmm.
Because people are running to these things because they're depressed. Let's be honest. You know, if people aren't living an authentic life, people are just trained to go to work, do the 9-to-5, pay your bills. Hopefully, you know, you could get a retirement or a pension or whatever and live it out until you croak. That's bullshit.
Right.
You know, that's bullshit. and there's a part of us that all know in the back of our mind that that's bullshit and that's not a way to live. You know, that's a false way to live. You're just, you know, it's so, you know, I remember I had a great opportunity, right? I was about 15 or 16 years old. And I was invited to this conference called the Men's Wisdom Council.
Mm.
And it was a very, very, very interesting conference. I got a scholarship to attend it. I was about 16 years old at the time. Youngest guy there, only person of color there. And what was interesting was the conference was about examining what does it mean to be a man in the 21st century. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Now you had men from the ages probably the late 40s up to probably late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And what was so interesting about my experience there particularly was that a lot of these men were considered by society very well-to-do, all
mm-hmm.
right? Very successful, you know? Some of them doctors, lawyers, different people, riding up to, it was in Rowe, Massachusetts where we was at, riding up there with their very expensive cars. And the thing that was so interesting is that a lot of these men were unhappy. All right. A lot of them did not have a connection to their children, did not know how to communicate with their wives, workaholics. And it was a safe place for them to grieve for the first time, for them to actually, and you know, let's be for real, you know, this whole macho man thing is killing men here in this country.
I agree.
Where we feel like we can't even be open enough to be vulnerable or to be able to show what's going on. And some of us are so detached to our feelings that we don't even know how to feel.
Right.
You know, and that's where a lot of that alcoholism and the drug abuse and all that comes in, because people are starving to feel, you know?
Yes.
So, it was a very eye opener for me. Because, you know, I was so young at the time, and I'm seeing that this is what the whole world is being pushed at, was like, hey, the American dream is to have a big, you know, house and be wealthy and you'll be all set. And that's a fucking lie.
Right.
That's a fucking lie, man. Because the thing is that it is, you know, because it was a proven point right there. It was a case in point right there.
Yep.
And we see that every day, even with the so-called celebrities.
Right.
A lot of these people, very attractive, got the fame, got the fortune. But you look in the tabloids, this one's getting divorced. This one's hooked on this. This one's hooked on that.
Yep.
And what people are not seeing is having an authentic, real life.
Yep.
Learning how to really live.
Yes.
You know? And people are not living, you know? They're not, you know, they're living this plastic life. And that's what I think these teaching plans help people break on through, like Jim Morrison said, break on through to the other side.
Right.
And that's what people have to do. They got to break on through because they're living in this very illusionary type of way.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I see that a lot, you know, so we're not meant to be slaves for a corporation. We're not meant to be just to live here and work your ass away. You know, yeah. that shit is fucking dead.
Yes, indeed. Amen, brother. Yeah. Amen. So we're just about getting to the end of our hour. But I wanted to kind of wrap things up and talk again about a little bit about your work. If people want to reach out to you and learn more about what you do, learn more about some of the activities that you plan in Boston, because you're always posting some very interesting things going on, nature walks and bringing people into town to talk about different things. So why don't you tell people a little bit about how they can reach you?
Well, they could reach me at my cell phone anytime they want at 617-386-9502. Again, that's 617-386-9502. Or you could email me anytime you want at lovemotherearth33@gmail.com. Okay.
Great.
And yeah, man, you know, I'm always open to meet new people and chit chat or whatever, you know. So yeah.
Right on. And then I would also like to ask you, one of the things that Brett and I talk about a lot is the really noticeable lack of diversity in the psychedelic community. And you touched on it a little bit about, you know, that the Black community in general thinks of it as sort of like white people stuff. And I'm wondering what you think that we can do as white people to, you know, to do our part to like break down some of that and, you know, make people feel welcome and feel included and, you know, give voice where voice deserves to be given, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think that, that's a deep question. And I think that, I just don't see that only in the psychedelic community, but I see that in a lot of different communities, unfortunately, over the years. You know, I've been involved in a lot of different schools of thought, you know, in Buddhism, Taoism, different Hindus. I went to so many different temples and different things over the years, Hare Krishnas, and it would be the same dynamic, you know. You probably have one or two, three Black people or maybe even Latino or Asian, and the rest is middle class white people, right. You know. And so I think it's a big issue. And I think if anything is a lot of it is just to be, just to be real with each other, you know, to be authentic. I mean, I think that, I don't think it's any particular blueprint or way to change it, but I think if anything, what white Americans can actually do is actually just, you have some environments where, how can you make things a little more welcoming? Well, don't, you know, some people, I know some Black people that they go to certain events, and they feel very isolated, feel like no one talks to them. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's the opposite where the spotlight's on them and they feel like they're being overburdened or, you know, too much attention on them. So I think it's just really being authentic and coming from a place of really welcoming everyone from a very sincere place. Mm-hmm. It's there's a lot of subtle racism. Just because some people write books or go on retreats or took ayahuasca or iboga or even psilocybin doesn't mean that they've dealt with their shit. Right. You know what I mean? That's just real. Yeah. And there's a lot of, I mean, it's a lot of healing that has to happen. You know, a lot of healing that has to happen, you know, just doesn't happen overnight. You know, had so many years of slavery, like I said. Then you had Jim Crow, and then, you know, like I said before, even dealing with, the CIA bringing crack cocaine into the neighborhoods. And the list goes on. The Ku Klux Klan, all these shootings happening by police officers. There's so much healing that has to happen even along the race issue, you know, which to me, it's ridiculous because when you start to go deeper within these teaching plans, you start to see the oneness of everything, you know. Yeah. But until that really gets concrete in people's heart, then they, you know, a lot of people will slip back into their old habits and their old ways. Mm-hmm. And, a lot of people take things for granted. You know what I mean? There's a guy named, what's his name? Tim Wise. He's a very interesting guy he's a white guy that tries to educate a lot of white people on racism. Mm-hmm. And, it's interesting. He said something that I found very interesting. He said, when it comes down to the police shootings, he says, there's a I don't have to, he said, I don't have to have a conversation with my kids that you have to be very careful when the police pull you over.
Right.
You know, he says that conversation will never come up, you know, but yet that's a conversation that has to happen with black families, you know, right. Hey, you know, a son, a black boy, his father would have to tell his son, hey, you know, the police pull you over. You make sure your hands are on that steering wheel, yeah. And make sure you vocally say to the police officer, I am going into the glove department to get my license or registration or whatever.
Right.
There's certain realities that aren't, that just white people aren't aware of.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, many black people felt since day one, at least in this country, that they've never been welcome, never been at a place of really being able to strive just to live.
Right.
You know, so there's a lot of healing that has to happen. But right. I think that healing can happen when people are authentic with each other,
mm-hmm.
Coming from a place of love.
Yeah.
I think that's the key word, love.
Yes,
love, sir. You know. So if you come from that place, people can feel it. Doesn't matter what color you are.
Yeah.
And when people come to these places, black, white, or whatever, when people, especially people of color, they'll feel that love.
Mm-hmm.
And feel like, wow, you know, that was a real great experience. And they'll tell other black people about it,
mm-hmm.
and say, hey, man, them people over there, they were really cool. Man, you know, let's go over there. I went there. Let's check it out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about love, man. You know, if people can come from that level, then I think that can heal a lot of stuff.
Right on.
You know, I think it's very simple.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Dooley, I want to thank you so much for being on today.
Man, I appreciate it, brother.
Yeah, and keep us informed about your conference upcoming. We will make sure to promote it as much as we can on our Facebook page and on the website. And we will continue to collaborate, sir, because I think you're a beautiful soul.
Thank you, man. I appreciate your beautiful soul as well, brother.
Right on.
All right.
Thank
Have
you
a
so
wonderful
much.
Night, man, and peace to everybody. All right.
All right, man. Thanks so much.
One love.